This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Bella Catering. BellaCatering.com.au is where you can find Sydney's best catering company. And now they're doing home delivery. Check out what they've got. Get to it fast, Sydney. Victoria is already shut down, which is good. They're acting like idiots down in Victoria, but we are no less idiots here in New South Wales. So, my dear friends and listeners and folks, you, of course, have come across folks who are not doing the right thing with COVID-19. You need to contact Bella Catering while you can. Get the people to your house now that you want to visit. Check their temperature before they get in the door. Make sure that they're hand sanitized. Feed them with some delicious Bella Catering food. BellaCatering.com.au. They are responsible for the show this week. We must thank them. We must love Glenn and Maria and thank their team and everything they do. Now, let's get on to the show.
We got a problem?
Nobody set foot off this bus.
What do we do for you?
We're looking for one of your players.
One of my players?
Smash Williams, coach. There's a whole lot of witnesses saying he threw the first punch. Now, we got an aggravated assault complaint, and we are bringing him in for questioning.
Telling me that you're going to blame one of my players for what happened down that field tonight?
This is police business, coach. This ain't got nothing to do about football. Now, you go on there and get that boy right now, or we will go in there and drag him out ourselves. It's your call.
Well, here's my call. You got a warrant, officer? Because if you don't got a warrant, we all know that you ain't going to get on this bus.
I can go get a warrant.
That's fine. We got all night.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. I'm really excited whenever I get to talk to anyone who's based in Washington, D.C. I'm particularly excited to talk to anyone who's a reporter who's worked in and around the Washington Post, the hallowed halls of the Washington Post. And today, although on a completely separate beat, way more concerned with sports than anything else, is my current guest. But I'm excited to talk to her nonetheless because she's an editor, and one of the things that she talks about is, like, I like making your writing better. And I think that the whole ethos of this show and what is so comforting, and maybe why it's such a salve when we watch this film, is that people are working tirelessly, obsessive grinders, to get a story right. And they have editorial support and protection and people who are making them as writers better, making them better reporters, and ultimately making some of the most, you know, defining journalism of the 20th century. So it's my pleasure to talk to a former sports editor at Washington Post Express and SB Nation, Sarah Kelly. Welcome to All the President's Minutes.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Now, before we get started, I asked you to be on the show. You were in the middle of a whole bunch of things, and one of your friends, fortunately, thanks to them, and I don't know who they are, but thanks, knew what we did at 1-8-Minute Productions and were fans of the shows, or at least a fan of one of our many things that we've done. And you were kind of weirded out that an Australian on the other side of the world has something so quintessentially American and Washingtonian, and I thought this, we were just talking about it off air, but I thought I would talk to you about it because then we can reveal, like, something. Now we are in the 68th episode of this show, and I thought there's a little bit of secret history stuff that can come up at the almost halfway mark.
So special shout out, I guess, to Miles Klee. He works for Mel Magazine. Yeah, Miles, right. He's doing something similar on Twitter for laughs about Heat, I think, you know, and so he was like, yeah, Blake's where I got that idea from. And it's the only person I asked about it, and it ended up being the exact right person to be like, hey, is this legit? And it is. I like to download podcasts and then just never, ever listen to them. I've just got like a huge queue of podcasts, especially because I don't commute anymore. So I've been trying to tackle those, but... That was cool. And then, so obviously I did my research, you know, and I was listening to see like what this is, and was really thrown off by the, you know, Australian accent. And then, you know, did the research and realized you're in Australia. But Was not expecting that, yes, because All the President's Men is such a quintessentially American movie. It's so much part of the sort of, you know, the myth or the building up of what the Washington Post is and what journalism is. And it's such like an intense thing for us here. And then also I just thought Blake sounded like a very American name.
it probably is. I think my mum stole it from a young man who was already a Blakehead, like in her extended friend group. And I think they got it from an American. So yes, it is probably the name is deceptive. But what's so funny, Sarah, and I haven't actually, in talking to you this morning, I realize I haven't actually said this live, is when I was conceiving of this show, and people who've listened to things we've done on One Heat Minute Productions, you know, I've gone off and done podcasts for other publications that aren't on this feed and done like little bits and bobs where you know, you're working for another publication. So it's not necessarily holistically our stuff, but it's a lot of our same team that come along on the fun rides. Mm-hmm. And I pitched this show to the Washington Post and got knocked back. And it was one of the only places that I pitched it. And it's one of those things where I went off and I spoke to some producer friends at the LA Times and you know, and I'm like, there's no real other American publication. You know, there's probably podcasting houses now that would be listening to this going, oh, okay, maybe that would have been something to be interested in a probably more condensed form than the minute by minute.
It's kind of a long commitment.
It is. But I think when I was pitching it to the Washington Post, I was like, this could be, you know, it's under your banner would be a really interesting way to do this, because it would be, you know, probably a very, could have taken a different turn as far as leaning into more like journalists themselves and journalist interviews that were there on the ground during Watergate and those portrayals and things like that and under that banner. But I kind of was like, just like with anything, this is the beauty of podcasts, is you kind of do, you know, your integrity and your ethics about like whether a topic is covered and doing it is the only thing that is holding you back. Like I never would have done it if there was another minute podcast or even like another great series. Leon Neyfakh's Slow Burn series just about Watergate is probably, you know, something that mm-hmm. I listened to and I loved, but it's so about the ephemera of all the things that are around Watergate rather than the sort of quintessential stuff about the movie and its influences on pop culture and just as influences on American culture and the culture of journalism in general. But still a terrific show, and I enjoyed talking to him on the show earlier on in the series. But yeah, it's just one of those things, like ships in the night, we passed, someone said a no. and if any of those folks are listening, hello and welcome, and you know, This totally could have been branded as a Washington Post minute by minute show if that's what it was. But you know, it is what it is. I'm here, and I nothing would have stopped me wanting to talk about this movie. Nothing.
It was cool to watch because I hadn't seen it before either, and I didn't realize that it had been done so close to it actually happening. Like, you know, I'm looking it up, but in my head, I guess I thought it was done in like the 80s or the 90s. And so I see it's 1976 and how recent that is and how that must have been really interesting for those audiences and how well the people in the theater would have actually remembered all of this going down, and how I assume Woodward and Bernstein probably were still working at the Post, and how I guess I'd have to look that up, but probably. And just like how fresh that was. I didn't ever know that. I grew up believing that it was 100 years ago, I guess.
It still shocks me to this day. It's something that, you know, I think people might be getting sick of if they hear me on this episode, is the proximity is everything for me. Because mm-hmm. you know, that old historical, what is a primary and secondary source, you know, like, you know, obviously a primary source is the newspaper, is the daily news every day, people being there on the ground mm-hmm. looking at it. And the secondary source, you know, implies this sort of like this reflection, this point of, you know, where you can actually look at everything and then condense it into something that's digestible, because you're using all those primary sources to sort of have an opinion. And the thing that always strikes me though with this is, it is a real blurred line between what is a primary versus what is a secondary source, because these guys are writing the book and Bob Woodward is meeting with a sort of dogged Robert Redford begging him for the rights to the movie, saying the story needs to be told, like, you know, using his sort of narrative wherewithal to be like, hey, if you're going to tell this as a story, it needs to be about you guys, because everyone knows everything else about the story. They just don't know about you. They don't know about what you had to do to get this story. And that's really interesting. And then they're producing it while the book is being produced. And, you know, Nixon's out in 74, which is the culmination of the film, even though primarily, you know, sort of 72, 73 is the actual events that the film is portraying. And there it is, you know, it's being produced in 75, it's out 76. So it's a really, really interesting, it's a really interesting timeline for me always to think about, like, what that means. And like you said, if those guys are still in the offices, I imagine, you know, lots of pictures of Robert Redford are being cut out of different publications and put on Woodward's desk, and Bernstein, you know, like, his desk must have been mounting with cigarettes, you know, with, you know, after all the cigarette jokes in the movie, and just Dustin Hoffman, anything that Dustin Hoffman did for the rest of his life is probably stuck to Carl Bernstein's desk, or, like, you know, left on his keyboard or left on his typewriter, you know, at the time. And yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, it's just weird. It's just, there's no other way to describe it other than it's weird, because it's very unusual.
Yeah, it's unique. There are a few times that I want to say, I mean, like, so the Post is set in also the 70s. So, like, most of the people who were around at that time, by the time the Post is a more recent movie, yes, probably weren't in the newsroom. There was the one with the Boston Globe where
Spotlight.
Spotlight was kind of more along that line, I guess, where it was somewhat recent, but not quite as fresh as this, but it, you know, like, some of those people still work there and most of them are still in the business one way or the other. I forget where I was going with this point, honestly, but
I think what you got, I think I can preempt is, it's just that it's not usual to happen, especially, and it's good to, like, put the lens of a journalism film on it, because with Spotlight, like, the stories had broken and the sort of swelling public consciousness about all of the heinous acts that were sort of surrounded the Catholic Church and all the, you know, all the ways that they were complicit in sort of hiding child abuse had stormed through the media. And even as far as an absolutely harrowing but just completely affecting documentary called Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God, was produced by HBO. So there was starting to be these stories that were coming out that were taking the peripheral views of, like, hey, this story's heinous, you know, all the big tales, but there's actually even worse tales within the tales. There's mini stories within the stories. And, you know, so when Spotlight came out, it was sort of the thing to do. It was like Tom McCarthy sort of makes that choice to go, actually, we're going to take that All the President's Men, the film ethos, and dive into the actual morality of the reporters who uncovered this story to see why, because that's another big question. It's like, it was happening for so long. Unlike the All the President's Men thing, which is that, yes, political malfeasance seems like part of the job. But I think that for Spotlight, it was like, well, how in this town was this happening for so long without it getting to the papers? A completely different thing. But to your point, that's so long later. It's so long later. It's plenty. It's time. There's books written. There's, you know, it's career defining for a lot of things. It's there's other documentaries already made, and it just doesn't. You know, and I just want to really qualify, this happens all the time, or has happened all the time, where a topic in the news or a story has been made into, like, TV or movie media or, like, Lifetime movie stuff. But most of it's terrible, and none of it really carries the same weight of the prestige of all of these actors or producers. It just doesn't. It doesn't seem to resonate on that same level.
So I just discovered actually an interesting connection between the two movies that I didn't realize. Well, between the whole thing anyway, is that Marty Baron was a new editor in 2001 at the Boston Globe when all of this stuff was going on with Spotlight, and they had the Spotlight team and they'd started doing these investigations. Marty Baron is now the executive editor of the Washington Post. Wow. And so that's fascinating. I didn't know that. I mean, I knew he was executive editor of the Washington Post, but that's kind of all I knew. So it's interesting to see some of these people have absolutely built careers on stuff that, you know, ended up being interesting enough to make a movie. But I just remember Spotlight being praised for the accuracy of, you know, Rachel McAdams wearing some like Old Navy khakis and kind of that look of, you know, like these are not even, you know, in large markets, they're not super well compensated people. And, you know, certainly not, not usually as glamorous looking as a lot of the depictions of journalists you'll see. So I think it's really cool.
But not Carrie from Sex and the City is what you're saying, right? You know, right.
Carrie writes once a week and can somehow afford a lot of very expensive shoes and her own place in New York. And yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And she's not a very good writer either. So we never understood how any of that worked, but the way that Rachel McAdams looks in this movie, she really looks like she might work for it. You know, like, I mean, you know, Boston Globe is not a nobody job. Like that's a significant market and a significant role, but you know, that it's still just like, it's still just a job and it's still just somebody, you know, dressing like a regular person and not like a movie star.
I don't know how true this is, but I love to talk about it. I love to talk about it when it's brought up in conversation. So I'll talk to you about it now. It's at the time, Sex and the City, obviously an insanely popular show, really popular, but one of the great funding tricks of that show is that a lot of designers would pay to have the girls, especially Carrie, wear their stuff. So Sarah just has Carrie wear their stuff. So HBO are making, you know, Sopranos, it's expensive, but there's no product placement in the Sopranos. And
not really.
And one of their other massive shows at that time, which then died a very unglamorous death at the end of season three with many seasons to go, is Deadwood, before it came back with the eventual movie that kind of wrapped it up. And one of the things was Deadwood wasn't making money like Sex and the City because they couldn't have product placement. It's not like Calamity Jane can wear Manolo Blahniks like through the muck of Deadwood Town. So yeah, it's just one of those shows that I think is probably the greatest fusion of product placement maybe ever since like a Michael Bay Transformers movie. There's probably nothing that has ever come close to like a Transformers movie.
It's so seamless. I never even thought about it. Like, of course it was paid placement, but like I didn't know what Manolo Blahnik was until Sex and the City. I also was probably not old enough to know or care before then, but I mean, you know, half the designer names that I knew at that time definitely came from there, and it never occurred to me that these would be product placements. That's how seamless it was. I'm like, this is like blowing my mind because of course that's the case, and I had never considered it before.
The most cost efficient, and I, you know, a topic for another podcast, a topic for another time, but possibly the most cost-efficient show ever made. Big stars, a hell of a lot of product placement, and like that product placement was probably ate into like 80% of the production budget. They probably put, no wonder the show could go for years and make two movies because everything was just bought and paid for straight off the bat. So this movie is part of the fabric of American identity because of how important the entire Watergate situation was to American identity in the 70s. It was a sort of, you know, American exceptionalism and American triumphalism is another word to talk about. Comes out of World War II and, you know, the Americans' role in changing the face of the world by sort of injecting itself into World War II come 42 and, you know, liberating Europe, et cetera. So you come out of that and it's a huge time of prosperity for white America. And in the 50s, it's all around the world. It's unparalleled peace and prosperity, especially in the Western world. Suburbia is created, the concept of a teenager. And we roll into the 60s and some of the discontent, you know, there's this beautiful facade that happens at the end of World War II where everyone's just like, can we just not have death and, you know, people being depressed and dying? Can we just try and have prosperity and peace and calmness? And it's sort of this turbulent roll into the 60s and then into the early 70s with civil rights. And then there starts to be all of these simmering undercurrents, these things that have kind of been squashed down and covered up by this facade of like post-World War II glow, all sort of burst forth with the civil rights movement and burst forth with the political upheaval and assassinations and all those sorts of things that are happening in states at the time. And then you get to this moment where the sort of, I guess you'd say, like the inferred corruption of everything that had been going on in the United States at that time then explodes with Watergate, that the actual president of the United States, Richard Nixon, and his gaggle of cronies are practicing political espionage on a scale that has never been revealed before. And that was a turning point in American society, because it was like, we are going to hold truth to power and hold account to people in positions of power in a way that we've never done before. And we're going to use the Fourth Estate to do that. It is absolutely that. Can I talk to you a little bit about, does that, or in your experience as a journalist, does that purpose, does it still ring true? Does it still
ring true? It rings true really with me. So I've known I wanted to be a journalist since I was 12. I was 12, I was a very serious child. I decided that I wanted to be a journalist because I wanted to tell the truth is kind of the line that I'd used for a long time. And I was very moved by things like holding, you know, powerful people accountable and comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. I took that very seriously.
Please tell me there's a school paper story where you're holding a principal to account or something. I want to hear about young Sarah Kelly, the tireless journalist.
There were some fascinating things in high school journalism, because Kansas is one of very few states that has, I believe it's called an anti-Hazelwood law, which essentially means that high schools are not allowed to tell us what our student press can print. In most U.S. states, the high school can say this is not appropriate and cut it out if they want to. In Kansas and a few other states, they've said, no, that's not cool. And essentially have like a counterbalance basically to the Hazelwood case that says, no, they can, the Kansas Student Press Act, I think is what it's called, something like that. So our journalism teacher, every time that some of the other teachers or she could email about, this is not an appropriate thing to put in a, you know, a student newspaper, she would just, you know, mail them a copy of the law that said in Kansas, like they're not allowed to tell you, you can't print that. So we ran some pretty racy things, even for a college town, you know, fairly liberal, fairly, you know, easy to get a lot of things through. But there had been a couple of jokes I remember we got in trouble for. We had like a comedy calendar thing and made some, I guess, some joke about Mardi Gras and Catholics have confession for a reason. And then honestly, I'm not kidding, might have been a joke about like a hooker named Steve or something, which I'm not like, I didn't write that, and also I'm not super proud of it. It's kind of homophobic now, but at the time, anyway, we got kind of a little bit in trouble with it, and we realized at that time that our head principal's name was Steve.
Oh my God.
And that was an awful, like, yeah. So somebody on the school board didn't like that comment, and actually they were probably right to not like it, but it became a whole thing, because as much as that, like, fairly isn't really appropriate, honestly, the school did not have a right to tell us we couldn't print that. There had been a lot more righteous examples of that in the state where, you know, people wanted to talk about maybe teen pregnancy or something like that, and they thought it would make the school look bad, things like that. Yeah. We used it mostly to make stupid jokes, was how we wielded that power. but, you know, even from then, I took it very seriously, like that it was my job to make sure that the administration was doing what it said it was. And that, you know, we should be looking at where the money goes, and we should be looking at, you know, what powerful people are doing, because I mean, that's part of their jobs, you know. So I've always felt really strongly about that, even in sports, and even after having a pretty intense and weird and not entirely successful career in journalism, that's still very important to me. Other people, I think, get into it more because they like to write, and sometimes you can kind of see the difference in people who wanted to write and became journalists and people who wanted to be journalists and maybe learned how to write. Yeah. And that, it's kind of two, and most of the time we can get along and we're good for each other, but there's kind of two slightly different orientations within any newsroom.
That's a really interesting thing, is that impulse for truth telling and then just being a great writer. So your door is opened. And also I don't think you should diminish what sports is. Sports is great because it's like a sandbox of playing, but there's all the same political, like, you know, weird political things, cities being tied to money and how that works, mm-hmm. and owners and all of their own weird politics and how that plays out, you know, especially like the hypocrisy of the NFL, for example.
It's full of really interesting labor issues constantly. And then, you know, a lot of interesting kind of reflections of what's going on in society and the way that we treat, you know, racism, I guess, would be the best example right now. And everything that's changed since Colin Kaepernick was, you know, basically expelled from the NFL for kneeling. And now that's what everyone's doing. And that's the kind of sports stuff I really like to do, is to be like, this is important. And this is a reflection of us. And this is sometimes how we move. And this is, I love sports because it's like the safest, most like low risk way to feel intense emotions. And that plays out really well when a lot of other things are going on in our society like they are right now.
And it's also why people get affected by sports. So mm-hmm. you can love something so much and you can be so disappointed. Like, there's a purity of the actual game, like watching people compete against one another and having sort of a, we hope, mostly level. If you watch, you know, the documentary Icarus on an Olympic sports level, you learn that no one is on the level playing field when you're in Olympic sports. But, you know, we hope that most people are on that level playing field and they're competing against one another. And it's literally about skill and will and the combination of those things. But also, you know, speaking in Australia, because we're not without our own sporting scandals and drug scandals and whatever, it's like you can have a great team performing, it's wonderful, you know, they're everything to you, and then your team breaches the salary cap and then they get stripped of their title, and you're like, there's nothing more heartbreaking for like a diehard sports fan to have watched and clawed for all these years to watch their team be successful and then get embroiled in a controversy. And it's like, oh my god, like, just, we just want to watch the game. And so I think that it's a really interesting one. And also, you know, one of my favorite, you talk about this being a quintessential text. One of my other favorite sort of quintessential sort of American texts, obviously you got things like The Wire, which is incredible. But I really love the TV show Friday Night Lights, because in Australia, we don't necessarily have a sort of high school sporting culture. Like, definitely kids are playing sports by then, but a lot of it is like fed into local sporting clubs and divisions and things like that. So by the time you kind of, I want to say about 14 or 15 years old, you're playing in juniors for rugby league or rugby union clubs around your local areas, and they then feed into what eventually become our professional teams. And so there's these little feeder clubs and you play, and then, you know, you sort of rise to the top. There's not like formalized draft or like high school to college to the NFL, for example. So when I look at something like Friday Night Lights and sport, like, that's the whole, it's a portrait of America through a town, you know, talking about labor, it's talking about teachers, it's talking about students, it's talking about like pathways out of poverty. It's got all the stories.
I am actually really excited you said that. I don't know if I told you this, but my first job out of college was as a sports copy editor in a relatively kind of small town in Texas.
It didn't
seem relevant. It's actually apparently very relevant. You know, and so that culture is very much there. I was in Bryan, College Station, Texas. So we're looking at, I think maybe Bryan was maybe around 100,000, and College Station is kind of a twin city there that's got Texas A&M and is maybe, I don't know, 150,000. So not as small as Dillon, although Dillon is also as big or as small as it needs to be, which I thought was interesting. It's also as far west or as far east as it needs to be. I always thought, because Texas is enormous, right? And so the original Friday Night Lights is based on a team from Odessa Permian that's very far out west.
Yes.
Way, 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 way into western, like West Texas. And yet in like season, maybe is it two or three, they're making all these like very frequent trips to Austin, which would be like 8 hours away. And the Texan definition of a long drive is, you know, probably 4 to 5, 6 hours. Like, they drive a lot. It's a huge state and there's not a lot of public transit. But suddenly it's like no longer, because they filmed, of course, they filmed the series, I think it was in Pflugerville, like just outside of Austin, which is in central Texas.
Yes.
So
8 hours.
Suddenly Austin is very much on the characters' minds, even though it's 8 hours away. It's not like nobody ever took a college visit to Austin from West Texas, but they make a lot of like real quick trips, and I guess I'd have to look it up. It's a very, very long drive because Austin is almost dead center in the state, and Odessa or vaguely like West Texas would be many hours away. So I always thought that was interesting, but yeah, that culture is not totally exaggerated. It was not as intense where I was as it could be in other places, but it was still pretty intense. They shut everything down. You can buy season tickets to the high school, which is not even a thing that they had even in Kansas, where I grew up. It's cool. I also was married to a high school football coach for 5 years. So, wow. So I've actually like experienced that Tammy Taylor life up close as well. And it's really cool and fascinating the way that these communities come around it. And especially if you're not accustomed to the,
you need a t-shirt that says that Tammy Taylor life with a silhouette.
Yeah.
You need that right now. Stat. That must be
a grind.
I was going to say it's insane. Like, there's another terrific, the terrific Netflix docuseries called Last Chance U, which bounces around obviously yes. on the peripherals of college football. And like you watch these, the coaches just in general have like a standard 18-hour day. And this is just like a mm-hmm. quarterback coach. And then you've got these grinding partners, wives and mothers and whatever it is, just going, hey, I'll see you when you come home to sleep for 3 minutes and I have to move the house. Like if we move next week, like they pack the house.
Right, then that would be on me, house. Yeah.
Yeah, you've got everything to do and they've got the team. It's an insane commitment. It was really old school and feels like, you know, past generational commitment to that kind of concept of home and work.
And it was very much a challenge as someone who was, you know, I was also working full time and, you know, was also a feminist and trying to have this feminist marriage life, you know, and the schedule didn't really allow for it to, at least during the season, be equal. He was the freshman head coach, which meant that he also was an assistant for the high school level. And in US, usually high school coaches are also teachers, full-time teachers typically.
Yes.
So he would leave the house by probably 7 a.m. and 4 days a week, he would have practice and he'd get home around, I don't know, like 8 p.m. And then he'd have, he'd have a game, usually Friday night, the high school game. And then he'd have the freshman game also, another night, I guess. And so he could come home anywhere from 9 to more like 11. Friday nights, I would be at the game with the other football wives living like that life and being there and knowing all the kids. And
in Australia they call it the wags, the wives and girlfriends.
Yes, exactly, wives and girlfriends. Right, yes. So we had a special little area where we would sit, wives and girlfriends and the children and everything, and then we'd go back to the head coach's house after the game. But some of those, especially the away games, they would come back, you know, very late after midnight occasionally. And then Saturday he spent all day watching film, so he was home. But he was on his iPad breaking down film for, you know, 5-6 hours that day at least. And then Sunday they had meetings at the head coach's house. So he'd be gone another couple of hours on Sunday and then it would start all over again. So it was my job to take care of the dog and the food and clean as much as I could clean and, you know, handle whatever I could for the entirety, basically like 3 or 4 months.
God.
It evened out the rest of the year. Like my ex-husband's not like a bad person or anything, but like that was what was required of him. And this is pretty low level, you know, he was an assistant coach at a big school in Kansas, which isn't like a super intense football state. So, you know, like in Texas, actually the head coaches stopped being teachers at that point. Oh yeah. Yeah. And he was teaching in the middle of the day too. Like he was teaching special ed, or social studies, depending on which year. And so, you know, still have to do all of that. That's still its own job, you know, and all of the lesson planning and all of the being in the classroom.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. He had a full-time job that was not football. And then the football also was about more or less a full-time job for, you know, a lot less money than it probably should be worth for the kind of hours you put in. And he'd always say, I'd do it for free if I had to. So he's doing great and he just got promoted or whatever at a different school. And so, but that's what it takes. And that's not even super high level. Like they had a really good year that year and it made it pretty far in playoffs, but didn't make it to state. And it was like a fraction of what you would see Friday Night Lights, but all of those elements are real, the way that a community comes around it. the kind of time and so much of your life that you sacrifice to it as a player, as a coach, as a parent, as literally someone who's just married to someone who works there. It is pretty well represented actually in Friday Night Lights. And I think that's a really, they kind of nailed Texas in my opinion, as much as King of the Hill did, which is the other like quintessential Texas.
That
absolutely nailed it. It's complete, like 100% accurate.
Every single state in the States and every country in the world needs those defining texts. I think if your two defining texts are King of the Hill and Friday Night Lights, you're not doing anything wrong. You're doing everything right. Oh, that's so great. But no, like when I'm hearing you talk about it, when I'm hearing about the grind, I'm just like, that is like, that's day-to-day American culture playing out in the world. When do you, you know, all of the manifestations of like politics and town politics and all those sorts of things and people's egos who are contributing to the school and helping with sponsorships and the whole way that these towns operate. It's like, you've got these little microcosms of economies and star players and all those sorts of things. It's and just the grind, that grind, like that's a, you know, I can't even imagine what that's like to have kids too. Kids is another layer of demands on top of
several
that.
Several of the coaches had 2-3 kids and they were just always in tow. I remember very distinctly, the football facility was shared with several schools in the same district. And so every now and then there'd be a Thursday night game for the varsity instead of a Friday night.
Yes.
And so the little kids would come. I think one of the head coach's youngest was probably 3 or 4, maybe. There were some like little, like preschool and kindergarten, first grade age kids.
Out till 9 o'clock at night.
Later, like sometimes closer to 10. Yeah. And of course, then they're cranky because normally game nights mean they get to go over to their, you know, their friend's house, the head coach's house.
Yes.
And have like we hang out and then they all hang out with the cool toys that the coach has and it's great. And they stay up super late Friday nights. Like they're up until probably 10:30 or 11 at minimum. They're probably up till midnight on Friday nights. These little kids. The oldest one I think was maybe 10 at the time or something. And they're all little. And but Thursday nights, of course, they can't go over to their friend's house. Thursday nights, they're already up way past their bedtime and then they have to go straight home and straight to bed, which is not what I want to do maybe what I wanted to do as an adult, but you know, kind of really not what they were hoping for. And it only happens maybe 2 or 3 times in a season. So they never really get used to that change in it. And I just remember the grumpiest, most tired little kids. There was one game where the team was losing badly and they could have put in a mercy rule, but the other team's coach decided not to because he just didn't want to. And then they kept dragging it out. They kept
running up the score.
They kept running the ball. And so it would take forever and ever and ever. And we're like, it's Thursday. All these kids have to be in class at like 7:45 in the morning. You know, and they still have to go home and they haven't done their homework yet. And all of this kind of stuff. And it really became a lifestyle. And my secret was to never stop moving. I would just, you know, get as much done as I could before work. And then I had one of those jobs where I didn't really do anything. So I just like killed 8 hours that day doing marketing, whatever that is.
I was just about to ask you, like when you're in that town and you start up in a paper, like, or you're doing any kind of reporting in sports reporting is, like, does that change your relationship to it? Because you're asking questions as a sports journalist about the town and about the coaches and doing the write-ups. Like, did you ever have any of that pressure come back on you?
Well, you know, it would. I actually was not working in journalism at the time because there were no journalism jobs. This was in Wichita, Kansas. There was one newspaper there and they just weren't hiring. So I did random marketing.
Just really quickly that we've brought it all the way back around. Where he's like, where Woodward gets called out that he's from Wichita, Kansas. And he's like, I'm not Wichita, Kansas. I'm from Illinois. But all the way from Wichita, Kansas, they didn't have any journalism jobs. So you're just doing like a marketing job during the day, like making ends.
Yeah. Just at like a bank or something. Yeah. Just like some job. And it really was, a lot of it is one of the tensions. I don't want to like throw all my garbage out there, but one of the tensions in this marriage is that football coaching is one of those jobs where you relocate to follow the job.
100%.
Often to maybe smaller towns where you can have a bigger role, kind of depends. But like, you know, you go where the football goes. Journalism is also one of those jobs where you go where the next job is, where the next beat is, where you could, you know, get a promotion or be in a bigger market or something like that. And so that was always a conflict in that marriage because it was hard to make them both coexist. So I wasn't working in news at the time. I know at the time there was a longtime sports writer, Joanna Chadwick, who was married to one of the high school basketball coaches. And so they, she a few years ago ended up becoming a teacher, but for a long time had that tension where, you know, it was great because she knew what was going on and she knew all the kids, but you know, if there was ever any kind of difficulty that I would love to know exactly how she handled that because she did it for probably 10, 15 years being married to one of the coaches that I don't know if she covered that team directly, but she covered all the other teams in the district and in the area.
That's the, I mean, with such limited FaceTime that you're probably already getting with your partner, that's another wrinkle that you really don't need in your life. Do you, really need that? You wrote this that I don't like. Do you really need that? Probably not. You don't, or certainly you don't want it. That's and definitely part of it.
Definitely there's that potential conflict. And I, if I remember, that particular reporter was known for being very player friendly. Like her reporting was very much about the kids. This is high school level, you know? So it was very much about highlighting the kids. And that might be part of why she was oriented that way is that, you know, she was in that world and was very familiar with the grind and what that looks like for everyone. And, was like very much well known for being very character centered, very kid centered in her reporting, compared to someone who might go more storyline or go more, you know, X's and O's or something like that.
Well,
so I actually never got to meet her, but I would love to listen to all of the things that that she learned in that same market, married to someone in the same district for, you know, a couple of decades.
Well, let's get to the storyline of all the president's minutes. Let's go back to someone who's been accused of being in Wichita, Kansas, which is Bob Woodward.
Let's check out
let's check out the 68th minute of all the president's men because it's jam packed, and I loved all of that. I just want to tell you, Sarah, I loved hearing about that time because it's such an interesting, fascinating little slice of Americana. And if this show is anything, it's a little slice of Americana. And it's we just got to have a vacation outside of Washington, D.C., which we're usually so occupied in. But it's nice to come back. So let's come back together. We'll hear about what it's like for you, what it was like for you to work in Washington, D.C. and be around the aura of these journalists, or at least their, you know, the former hallowed halls of these guys. And we'll come back and talk about this moment in just a sec.
Their names? We haven't revealed the sources of people that have talked to us.
You know, I really can't talk about this because...
Would they be members of the committee? Someone got to that woman.
It's the key to the whole cover-up.
How can you write that there's a cover-up? We don't know that there's a cover-up.
Well, then I don't know what the hell you need. So you tell me what you need.
I need more fact for a story is what I need, and I think you should need the same thing.
Okay, if you get in a car, and there's
in a car.
All right, and there's music playing in a car, hypothetically. And there's music playing in the car for 10 minutes, and there's no commercial. What can you deduce from that? Is it AM or FM?
Come on, Bernstein.
Is it AM or FM?
Oh, a guy can come up to me on a street.
Yeah.
And he can ask me an address. Now, is the man interrogating me, or is he lost? What kind of a story do I write from? What kind of a deduction do I make from that?
Well, because you don't have a gut feeling that the woman is trying to help us?
No, I don't have enough gut feeling. I wish I did.
We're from the Washington Post.
A lot happens. And after all of the charm of like the first Betty Millen interaction where they're sort of very passively asking her questions and then they go back, it's kind of a heart-wrenching beginning to the minute. You know, they're kind of pushing this person. They're trying to get any semblance of information that they can get, just any sort of morsel. And it's sort of heartbreaking. And then there's this great talking shop, which I can't wait to talk to you about as an editor, of like, what deduction...
Right, yes. What so much of it comes together.
What deduction would you like me to make if this person is saying he's acting completely differently in two interactions? What kind of deduction would I make? What do you need to be telling a story? I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that back and forth between these guys.
Yeah, that's what I kind of was excited about when I saw everything that particular clip involved, because it's that process. They're kind of self-editing at this point, trying to determine, like, do we have enough information to make this a story? Which means, like, is this interesting, but also can we sort of prove it, or do we have evidence? And that's a lot of what editing is day to day, especially editing, you know, a section.
Yes.
Or being kind of an assigning editor like that is your news judgment is what you do every day. You decide what people should and shouldn't know, and you decide if you have enough information to share with people. There's a lot of, I guess, gatekeeping there that not everybody in the public realizes. Like, as much as we make decisions about what to cover, that means we're also making decisions about what not to cover and what, you know, and when to release the information that we have.
Yeah, because
that's what editing really is.
Yeah, that foundational sort of quandary of the way that this person is interacting with me is so drastically different, and they show so much fear that there is a moral responsibility to go, when writing this, do we say that they were interfered with? Because obviously I didn't see it.
Mm-hmm. And it
feels so relevant and prescient now of, like, who is making that judgment call? Because I know about you, it's like a lot of emerging, you know, publications, and you see, like, online digital publications or whatever, or like they're millennial skewed, whatever bullshit jargon that people ended up saying with these youth newspapers and stuff. And it feels like people are way more inclined to make that kind of claim, that it feels like the way that they interacted with someone would do that, rather than going and having this moment of, like, should I do this?
In some ways that can be true, especially for, you know, some of your quick hits, some of that, you know, where getting it first is the most important. I think that's maybe the most interesting tension in the movie, is there's, you know, always a chance that somebody else could pick up on this first.
Yes.
And so that's always what's kind of guiding these discussions, is do we have enough, but also if we wait to get more, is somebody else going to publish with less, or, yes, or are they going to get what we're looking for first? And so that's kind of always in the back of your mind when you're trying to decide if this is a story, is also, does anyone else think it's a story? So that's definitely something that comes up a lot. I'm not really sure if I can say that, at least at more traditional outlets, that the standard for what is and isn't news has changed too much. As far as, like, you know, like real stuff that would be news if we could prove it kind of stuff, like,
yes,
like Watergate, not like things like, you know, is this story about what somebody said on Twitter news? That's kind of a different question. But as far as, like, we've been investigating, do we have enough? That kind of has stayed the same, at least for the traditional outlets, and you have a lot of other noise from newer all digital outlets that have sometimes different standards, or, you know, they have the freedom also, of course, to update things as they come, which is not something you could do in 1970, whatever, no. In print.
No.
That also drives things very differently, the print deadlines and the nature of print, where you can run a follow-up story if you need to, you can run a correction, but it's not the same as being able to go online and go ahead and change it or update it with whatever you found after you published it.
Yes.
And be able to sort of update people on that. So there's a lot of finality too, that we don't necessarily have to deal with as much as modern journalists in deciding, like, is it time to hit go or not?
Yeah. It's also the way that they're putting it I like so much. It's like, if a guy comes up to you and asks directions in the street, just something about the turn of phrase, and something just about the whole word picture. If someone comes and asks you for where an address is in the street, is he interrogating you? Like, I just love that. That is, like, a great one, because it's like, that would it totally is possible. It would never occur to me. You know, I walk my dog, I go for a walk with my kids, and there's plenty of time where, like, I think when you have a dog, and especially small kids, and people, like, see you walking the street, they don't know where they are. They're like, this person must know where they are. Like, so you walk along, like, where is this place? And it happens quite a bit. And so I just love that idea of, there's never been a second thought, except when I watch this movie, of, like, someone's interrogating me for a location. I'm usually
Yeah, right.
I'm usually just like, I'm walking straight past them. I'm never moving. I'm never doing any of that. So it's just this really interesting thing that I always find when I watch this scene and I'm looking at this moment. But I also love the juxtaposition of there's such a great stack of filmmaking. These guys are ultimately shrouded in shadow, particularly Woodward at the beginning of the scene is sort of shrouded in shadow. They're staging themselves the same way they did the previous interaction. Hoffman's Bernstein is sort of the one who's actually bathed in the light. It's the soft light, warm hearth light coming from the inside of her house. The way she's gripping onto the door, it's, you know, the door is like holding her up in this moment. And she's like lilting like spinach in hot water, basically against this door, and then ends up shutting it. And the power of this scene, the mood of the scene, and the sort of, you know, delicate David Shire score that sort of like really sort of swaying your emotion in it is this person is under pressure. It's tickling all those paranoia muscles. But in this car, and it's the great technique of this movie, is that it really gives you a break. It gives you a feeling. It validates something. And then it makes you actually question all of the manipulation. And I think that's one thing I'm relishing about this scene with you watching it and talking about it, is that offset. Like those first, the opening moments, you are purely buying into the paranoia. People got to this person. There's no way that she would be acting like this if someone didn't get to her. It validates all of those slam doors. But then they get in the car and they're like, but did we really see that? Like, are we just crazy? Like, are we just tired? We've been on the road for so long. Are we just making this up in our head? And I think that check yourself constantly in this movie is just why you're satisfied with it. It's so excellent.
It is, especially I think from a journalist perspective, because these are some of the questions we're supposed to be asking. I think it really plays into kind of what our more modern conversation is about, like what is objective, and what is, you know, what point of view are we writing from? Because
yes,
you know, it used to be Woodward and Bernstein, like two white guys were writing everything, and that became the default point of view. And so we've definitely had a lot of conflicts when reporters and editors from different walks of life.
Oh, Sarah, you've hit mute.
How did I do that? Can you hear me?
I got you.
I don't know what happened there. I'm sorry.
reporters are from different walks of life.
Right. And so that's been especially an ongoing thing for several years, but also very much in the last few months with Black Lives Matter and things like that. Like the question, you know, are Black reporters inherently biased when they're covering these protests? And should they be pulled off these stories? And most of us now are saying, well, no, of course not. And 20 years ago, some of us, and by some of us, I really just mean white people, might have said, well, yeah, I mean, how can they not be biased? Because they would have a point of view. And so there's a lot of modern talk now of first that objectivity is a myth, and that pretending you don't have an opinion doesn't mean that you don't have it, and doesn't mean that it can't affect your reporting.
Yes.
And two, that our default is not a true neutral at all, that it's a very specific point of view. And that it's my opinion that you either, in all things, you either want change or you want things to stay the same.
Yes.
And either one of those is an opinion. Either one of those is necessarily political. Like, you either want the status quo or you don't. Like, you have to choose.
Yes.
You know, even if your choice is to do nothing, that's a choice. So that has been a conversation in journalism that I've been watching really closely.
And even, you know, we're recording this, so folks are going to probably hear it pretty quickly, only a couple of days after we actually record this. But, you know, there was a big story that broke that Barry Weiss, who was a New York Times opinion editor and recently gained a little bit more notoriety for signing the cancel culture Harper's letter that went out there with a whole bunch of other individuals, has now resigned from the New York Times from bullying and things like that. And it's just like that to me is sort of a manifestation in the current news climate of exactly what you're talking about, which is that someone's political opinion is there and it's right out on Front Street. And for whatever reason, whether it is legitimately bullying or whatever, it's coloring the way that person reports. We're trying to hold some journalists to an account of like a flat a flat political agenda, like a flat neutral, but it is a lie. Like the objectivity is in the way that you present facts versus what your personal opinion is about those facts. And I think we haven't quite gotten to that moment in the movie yet, but there's that great moment where Woodward's like, I'm a Republican, and Bernstein nearly falls off his chair, which is...
That's a great moment. Like, I almost fell out of my chair. I was like, oh, okay, I hadn't expected that. There aren't a lot of Republican journalists. They exist, but there's not, especially in print, there's not that many of them.
Yeah,
it's a great moment.
Maybe there was a lot more of them then in the 70s.
Probably.
Maybe many more in the 70s. Maybe the scales have tipped almost completely to the other way. But then it's then interesting to talk then about, you know, if there's not a lot of Republican journalists and there's not people that are willing to have the debate, then you go, well, that's why a Fox News exists, because there might be legitimate Republican journalists out there. And then it's like, no, then, you know, then who are we playing to? Who's this evil propaganda machine really playing to then? Like, what are we actually doing?
It's also a lot more stressful as the Republican, you know, agenda and the Republican platform becomes very divided from what I would describe as the mainstream in a lot of their views, where, you know, and people who are supportive of Black Lives Matter and things like that will say, like, the Republican agenda right now is arguing against the humanity of Black people and of gay people and of people, you know, various, a whole list of marginalized people. And that is, to me, and I think to a lot of people, a whole lot harder than what it might have been when it was just a disagreement about it, exactly how we should, you know, use our tax money or something like that. And that's kind of an oversimplification of the past, because, you know, it was like that because of systemic exclusion of huge groups of people. And that's why we didn't have to have those discussions then, is that we just cut those people out. But, you know, as the right moves so much further right, it's harder and harder for me to even feel like these are ideas that we should entertain. Like, as we have an uncomfortable creep toward, you know, weird fascist tendencies in the White House, it's harder and harder for me to be like, well, let's listen to someone who's pro-fascist and someone who's anti-fascist and, like, see where it falls. And so that's where I think a lot of journalists, especially maybe the ones that already kind of leaned a little bit left, are really, I don't know if struggling is the right word, but, like, it's really on our minds that, like, how much you can legitimize these when the opposite, you know, the party in power is got some pretty weird ideas that maybe we shouldn't give too much credence to.
But it's also the leader, you know, the extremity is towards the irrational. You know, it feels like there's no ability to have a rational conversation, because the implication is that, you know, go as far back as you want on both sides of political discussion, it feels like people were ready to have rational conversations. People were ready to say, to say what they believe without sort of screeching it or tweeting it or whatever the case may be. And I feel like I could go back and read every Nixon conversation in privately in the White House. And, you know, I think someone on the show talked about it, like reading like a David Mamet script. So I could totally do that. And I could watch Nixon interviews and see him be a rational human being. And I can't even read Trump tweets. It's just,
yeah,
like, it's insane. I'm not a local. I have the luxury of being in another country, and I have to, you know, I have to divest my attention away to focus on the politics of my own country, to talk about it. And I sort of can, you know, balance that on a knife's edge between this show and then, you know, my own personal beliefs as a more progressive person just in general. But I feel like it's like, if you have someone who's totally irrational, and wants to just be a bully and not have an interaction with you, you can't have a dialogue with them. And, like, so it's like,
absolutely,
even in interviews where Trump is being, like, lavished with praise, he's still a person who is waiting for you to stop speaking so he can speak, versus someone who's actually listening to any word you're saying during anything that's happening.
Right. Yeah, that's true. He's 100% not even trying.
He's not trying.
You know what? I think it's a lot of these attacks from the right are coming in bad faith. And I think it's a mistake for either people on the left or people who are trying to be neutral to engage these bad faith arguments, these bad faith statements.
Yes.
As if these are in good faith. The most recent one, I guess, would be the one that stands out to me, at least this week, was Josh Hawley. He's a senator from Missouri. He for whatever reason, sent out like a press release about how he feels about the NBA in China and comparing the NBA to communist China. And I don't know, making some kind of a point about that, I guess, which is an interesting thing to do. Missouri does not have an NBA team. I don't believe they have even any like G League teams. Like, it's neither here nor there. Missouri's coronavirus cases are rising. Kansas City has like extreme numbers of homicides right now. Like, he's got other things he could be doing, but this is what he's doing. And so he emailed this ESPN reporter, Woj, and apparently Woj just responded back with, "Fuck you." I and almost everybody else in sports thinks that's hilarious. ESPN thinks that maybe they need to suspend him because that's not civil or whatever, and that's fine. ESPN can do what they want, but you know, it really stood out to me as like, this is not a good faith attempt to engage an ESPN writer on anything. The reason we know about it is because Josh Hawley tweeted out that like the screenshot to be like, oh well, ESPN reporters, they are not very nice to me. And you can see the news release. It's a waste of everyone's time. I would say the same thing if someone sent this to my inbox. Like, this has nothing to do with anything. Nobody asked what you, like, your opinion. Josh Hawley is not a serious person.
I love your more massage version though, Sarah, of like, this is not an opinion that anyone needs to hear. You are clearly not a serious person. Goodbye. That's you editing in a very nice, like, diplomatic way of going back. Whereas we're just like, fuck you. Like, his is like, right, with all of the like, why am I even reading this? Why would I even waste my time? And yeah, look, that's the other thing. It's like, you can have, there are many forums to have rational conversations when you're talking about like commonality of the human experience and things we can agree on, and just starting from a point of like, this is where we actually want to agree and let's have a dialogue about it. And then there's irrationality completely, and then just insanity.
Yes. And in this case also, a lot of times it's, you know, contributing to people building up their own careers. Josh Hawley is trying to build his political career. He wants to run for president. He went to like Yale, I think. Maybe Harvard and Yale, but he does that like regular folks, Missouri, like yeehaw kind of thing. When there's nothing, he's like a millionaire. It's very much like, it's all a game for him to get his name out there, for him to, you know, basically piggyback on these Trump supporters, you know, and so he's leaned hard on politicizing, wearing a mask in public, things like that. That's not a serious person, and it's not someone you need to engage.
No.
And to me, that's like a very large form of editing, where I got this thing in my inbox, I decided this is not worth my time, and I move on. That's editing to me. It's deciding what gets your attention and what doesn't.
And also the attention of the reader. What should get your attention?
And particularly like being cognizant of not doing other people's PR work for them. That's a very important part of editing. Is it's not my job to make in sports your team look good, which is sometimes controversial.
Yes.
You know, my job is to cover the team. I don't work for the team, except for sometimes when journalists do literally work for the team. Everybody else though, you know, it's very tricky because of access, but in general, I don't work for the team. It's not my job to make your team look good. It's not my job to make your candidate look good. It's not my job to make your business look good. You tell me the information, I'll tell people, and we'll see what they think. And so that's another, like, really, I think, key part of editing that,
it's a funny dialogue that happens. This is the weird crossover. It happens in sports, and it definitely happens in entertainment. Is people, that whole concept of, if you like the movie, the company paid you off. You hated the movie. If you hated the movie, you're doing so because another company paid you off. And
yes,
okay with the movie, you're outside of the conversation, and who cares, because you didn't love it or hate it. And you know PR companies with, like, when it comes to movies and stuff like that, will send you things all the time. And you know, as an editor of like a small blog, like, you know, will you post this, will you do this, will you do this? And I'm like, no. Just like,
yeah,
I'm not posting a press release. There's no content here. Like, this could, you know, some of the information could be a companion to an interview, or a companion to a deep dive, or a companion to something. But is there something else? No, it's just the press release. Cool. No, I'm good. We're not going to need to post that. It'll pop up somewhere else. people aren't going to come to this publication for that. Thank you very much. See you later. And so it's one of those funny things, and it happens with Access, and you know, there's a lot of international movie publications that have been scrutinized, just like sporting journalists have been scrutinized of like, you're in the pocket of X, and that's, you know, you got access to this big interview, and therefore you're of course going to love it. You're of course going to love this thing, or, you know, then the editors of those publications have to go, okay, I got to go ride a tank with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Maybe I can't review this movie. Maybe I get someone else to review the movie, because if my review says that it's garbage, then I might not get the luxury of going to ride on a tank with Sylvester Stallone next week.
It's sometimes a very difficult line to walk. Like, I think almost all of us go into it not wanting to just cape for people, even if maybe we sense a small conflict of interest, or maybe we've always liked this, or in sports it happens a lot. Like, almost every sports writer went to a university. Many of them are universities with big sports programs.
Yes.
So a lot of the argument among fans will be like, this person shouldn't be covering Texas A&M, either because they went to Texas A&M or because they went to the University of Texas, the rival. Yes.
Yes.
And so if their coverage is not favorable, it's because if there are any Aggies listening, it's because they're what Texas A&M fans would call a T-SIP. You know, there's somebody who went to the University of Texas. SIPs. SIPs is what they call them for short. UT is the fancier school. Texas A&M is the agricultural school. And so that's kind of the basis of their rivalry, I guess. Saw it all the time. Or, you know, if someone says something negative about University of Kansas, where I went to school, there are a whole lot of sports writers who went to the University of Missouri, which was our biggest rival. And so we'd be like, well, that's, you know, we never get any fair coverage because everybody at ESPN went to Mizzou. And the second half of that is kind of true, but the first half is really not. Because we're all going into it trying to give like real good coverage, and what should be more important is looking at our unconscious biases. But I think in sports and entertainment, you see it even more, and in politics, you see it even more, because the access is so important. And if you say the wrong thing, if you report the wrong thing, you could lose your access to your sources, you know, and that gets you in trouble with your boss, and these jobs are not easy to come by these days. And so there's a kind of a real tricky line that I think on any beat, all of us are kind of trying to stay on the side of doing real journalists and being objective, but it's not always the easiest thing because of just all of these other things, these other factors that come into how the world works and how business works.
Sarah, this has been an absolute fascinating convo. I just wanted to thank you so much for being a part of the show.
I took it in so many directions. I hope some of them were interesting.
No, I think it is fascinating because it's really, first and foremost, it's extremely interesting to contextualize journalism of today and those quandaries. And secondly, it's great to, I think sports journalism is, you know, I think for whatever status people might talk about it, you know, when it's amongst, you know, political journalism or otherwise, it's like sports journalism is some of the most read journalism in the world. And personally, I read a lot of sports journalism because I like sports, and just like there's a great crossover between sports and entertainment. So it's fascinating to hear that you're dealing with the same quandaries and those same editorial decisions and having that consciousness. And also I think that there are definitely, you know, in at the beginning of this project, I probably had more of a fixed mindset around this speaking a direct one-to-one dialogue with what was happening in the world today, this film, All the President's Men. And I feel like now so much of what I maybe took for granted as, you know, being one for one is now, it's now outmoded. It's different. And I think hearing the context around, you know, those challenges and access and teams and biases, I think is something that kind of has to be addressed, because I think part of what the alchemy of this movie and the alchemy of the reporting is that these guys had different biases and they kind of kept each other in check. And even the people who made this movie, which some people would be hearing, had biases and kept each other in check. Including the editor of All the President's Men, who was a Republican, helping to make decisions in the editing room, and I'm going to just call him out right now. So it's Robert L. Wolf, who's also an editor for Sam Peckinpah, before he came into this movie, was, you know, a Republican, and helping them make decisions and telling, you know, and sort of guiding Alan J. Pakula and his team around, you know, are we being too heavy-handed? Are we coming at this too hard from a progressive standpoint and too political, instead of the objective, taking the adjectives away, if you were. But yeah, I think it's been a fascinating convo, and I've loved every minute. So I just want to thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Oh, this is so much fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
That was my incredible guest, Sarah Kelly. You can find her at the Sarah Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y, not E-Y, on Twitter. And you can also sign up to her Amateur Hour newsletter, where she's really getting a chance to write in the pandemic. Sarah, such a fascinating convo. Thank you so much for being a part of the show. Guys, thank you so much for listening to another episode of All the President's Minutes. We have a stacked lineup of incredible, both journalistic and film minds, and just incredible people that are giving up so much of their time to be a part of the show. So thank all of them in advance, and I hope you guys are enjoying it as much as we are enjoying putting every episode out there. Thank you so much for following along to One Heat Minute and One Heat Minute Productions just in general. Right now, the two main ones that are dominating our feed are obviously All the President's Minutes and the incredible Increment Vice. If you can do one thing for us, we don't need your donations right now. You know, we know everyone's doing it tough. So, you know, when we are all flush at the end of this pandemic, hopefully, touching wood as I'm talking to you, we'll take those donations then. If you can do one thing though, please subscribe, rate, and review the show. If you have an Apple iPhone and you jump on the Apple Podcast app, we know that there's a stack of listeners out there. If you're enjoying the show every week and you haven't yet, please go and subscribe and jump on there and hit a review, because they matter in the charts and they matter with the show sort of popping up in the featured episodes and things like that. So if you guys can do that for whatever show you're listening to, One Heat Minute, Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Josie and the Podcats, Increment Vice, Miami Nice, or of course All the President's Minutes, please jump on there. We'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much again for being a part of this experience and reaching out. If you want to reach me, at OneBlakeMinute on Twitter, or mail at OneHeatMinute.com for all of our shows. If you've got anything for Increment Vice too, I'm happy to pass it on at ATPMPod for this podcast. We'll catch you on another episode soon.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.